Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day back in 1952 that the very first rock and roll stage show was held. In which city was it held? Was it A, New York City, B, Philadelphia, C, Cleveland, or D, San Francisco? Where was the setting for that very first rock and roll stage show anyway? And question number two. A special section of Central Park in New York was renamed on this day in 1984. What was its new name? Was it A, Strawberry Fields? Was it B, Blueberry Hill? Was it C, California Dreamin'? Was it D, Xanadu? Or was it E, Kokomo? What was a section of Central Park renamed today, back in 1984, anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that very same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of March 20th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1685, that composer Johann Sebastian Bach was born. This famous German composer, organist, and violinist lived during the late Baroque period. Bach's B-Day, today, 1685. And it was 37 years ago today, 1989, that Dick Clark announced that he would no longer be hosting the show American Bandstand. He had been the host for 33 years, and that was today, back in
1989. Treat you quite as good as I should have. Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time. You were always on my mind.
Elvis's Always on My Mind introduces this memorial message. It's from Time magazine on the 23rd of March, 2026. It's titled, Baz Luhrmann Gives Elvis the Tribute He Deserves. In the 1980s and 1990s, you'd sometimes see Elvis Lives scrawled around this or that city or town. It was a furtive declaration with an unclear meaning. Was it a reference to the popular conspiracy theory that Elvis hadn't really died on August 16, 1977, at 42, but was hiding away somewhere, living as a private citizen? Or did it mean that after his death, the molecules of energy he'd left behind had simply taken another living shape? Elvis died one death, only to spring back in an infinite number of forms, as uncountable as the stars in the sky.
To keep you satisfied. I should have said and done. I just never took the time. You were always on my mind.
Always on my mind.
You were always on my mind.
But sometimes Elvis goes a little underground. His reform molecules can grow hazy in the past few years, but Lardman has done the most to bring them back into focus, first with his fantastically unruly 2022 biopic, Elvis, and now with a film that's less documentary than spiritual conjuring. Epic, spelled E-P-I-C, Elvis Presley in Concert is what it stands for, is constructed of previously unreleased footage. Lerman's Elvis researchers found this trove, 59 hours of performance and interview material, had been languishing in a Warner Brothers vault located in an underground salt mine in Kansas. In addition, Lerman sourced rare Super 8 footage from the Graceland archives. This footage, painstakingly restored, forms the fabric of Epic, which, despite Lerman's penchant for hurtling over the top, or maybe because of it, feels profoundly intimate. Epic mixes concert footage with clips of Elvis being Elvis, as if to collapse the distance between his public and private selves. Lerman hopscotched through Elvis's early career, breezing over the cheesy movies, his stint in the army, during which he lost his beloved mother, Gladys. We see glimpses of Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, whom Lerman frames as an evil manipulator, though in reality his role may not have been as diabolical. Lerman has also unearthed some hypnotic clips of Elvis performing in Hawaii in 1957, wearing a shimmering gold jacket, his neck ringed with a lei. This was Elvis's near the peak of his beauty, when his pleasure in performing seemed to bathe him in radiant light. No wonder he got under people's skin. What they saw and identified as profanity was really a state of grace. But the film's core is footage from the hundreds of performances Elvis gave in Las Vegas from 1969 to 1976. His costumes alone are a wonder. Bell-bottom jumpsuits accented with Revolutionary War-era collars and cinched with macrame belts. In some of the Vegas footage, it's possible to see glimpses of the desperate figure Elvis would become. The hint of a jowl, a thickening waist, a gaze veering towards blankness. But mostly, the Elvis of Epic is alarmingly alive. His moves are smooth. His voice sounds burnished and vital as he slides into poke salad Annie. Annie's story seems to mesh with his own. Those greens are all her family had, but they, quote-unquote, did all right. Lerman spins these words into an echo chamber, even as he superimposes a ghostly-looking picture, the famous black-and-white baby photo of Elvis nestled between his parents, atop the image of Elvis revving up to sing the song. In the picture, baby Elvis is the sunshine center of a family that also had nothing. Lerman isolates baby Elvis with his quizzical knowing face and sends him whirling towards us. Is it corny, or is it everything? Lerman's gift as a filmmaker, as well as the very thing that can sometimes make him annoying, is that he always errs on the side of everything. He gives epic his all, and its joyous abundance almost feels like more than we deserve, just as, maybe, we never deserved Elvis. And yet, there he was, giving us more, possibly, than he had to give. His life was great and vast and almost unbearably sad. The life he has now is better because he's given it over to us. And just by continuing to look at him and hear him, we build it anew, day by day. Box Sheep May Safely Graze introduces our classical music news. It's entitled Spring Highlights, WCPE Quarter Notes, Spring 2026. This is written by music director Emily Moss. Birthdays. Tune in to the classical station on Tuesday, March 31, as we celebrate the birthdays of two masterful figures in classical music, Johann Sebastian Bach and Joseph Haydn. Throughout the day, we'll honor Bach's unmatched mastery of counterpoint and spiritual depth, alongside Haydn's wit, warmth, and groundbreaking role in shaping the symphony and string quartet. From sacred works and intricate keyboard music to elegant symphonies and chamber treasures, hear how these two composers helped define the language of Western music. Join us for a day of timeless music that continues to inspire, challenge, and delight listeners centuries later. Once again, that's coming up on March 31, WCPE. Sir Duke introduces our jazz music news. It was, after all, on this very day, back in 1977, that this song by Stevie Wonder, as a tribute to jazz star Duke Ellington, was released. As noted in an AI overview downloaded on March 17, 2026, Stevie Wonder wrote Sir Duke, 1976, as a tribute to jazz legend Duke Ellington, who died in 1974, and as an homage to the musical pioneers who influenced him. Released on his album titled Songs in the Key of Life, the song expresses admiration for pioneers like Ellington, Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald, and Glenn Miller. In June 1977, Wonder told a Billboard-sponsored symposium at UCLA, University of California, "I knew the title from the beginning, but wanted it to be about the musicians who did something for us. So soon they are forgotten." I wanted to show my appreciation. On May 21, 1977, Sir Duke started a three-week run atop the Billboard Hot 100, replacing Leo Sayer's When I Need You. It was Stevie's sixth pop number one, only 4 months after I Wish had become the fifth. And in music research and technology, we have this article titled, Accordion Renews Its Image as 2026's Top Instrument. The accordion is gaining worldwide popularity. Germany has declared it the instrument of the year for 2026. This all-rounder is used across various genres, from tangos to heavy metal. This is written by Gabby Rocher in DW Magazine on January the 4th, 2026. Accordionist Matthias Matzke has a deep passion for his instrument, and his inspiration goes beyond its sound. You can really push yourself to the limit, and there's a correlation between muscle power and the sound produced, he said. Matzke's appreciation for the accordion began in his childhood. Now he serves as one of the ambassadors for the Instrument of the Year in 2026. The accordion sparks the imagination. Sometimes it sounds like an orchestra with wind instruments, but you can also cover pop songs wonderfully, he told DW Magazine. Germany's state music councils have been selecting an instrument of the year since 2008. This initiative highlights instruments that typically have a niche role in orchestras or are considered solo instruments, such as the mandolin in 2023 and the tuba in 2024. The focus is also on instruments that unite people across different musical genres. In 2025, the chosen instrument was the human voice, and in 2026, it will be the accordion, which enjoys a prominent role in many cultures, from Russia to Latin America and throughout Europe, breaking away from its outdated image. Renowned performers showcase the accordion's versatility through captivating live performances. Social media is full of clips featuring accordionists performing feats you wouldn't normally associate with the instrument. Matzke is particularly enthusiastic about digital accordions, which also work well in rock music. For example, I have an electric piano sound and can create new and fascinating soundscapes, he added. Write accordion for every genre. Hohner, the renowned German accordion manufacturer, is working to give the instrument a fresh image. The company offers a range of accordions that cater to various music genres, from folk to heavy metal. This diversity is reflected in their product line, which includes modern, trendy colors aimed at mainstream audiences, exclusive models for professional musicians, and special editions like the Corona II Los Tigres, created specifically for the Hernandez brothers of the Mexican band Los Tigres del Norte. The article skips down and ends with this. What our society needs now, especially in these times, is a way for people to come together and communicate through music, said Matzke. adding that the portable accordion makes this possible. While authentic live music is still in demand, it isn't practiced enough. He hopes that the Year of the Accordion will help to change this. So, how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question was on this very day back in 1952 that the first rock and roll stage show was held. In which city was it held? Was it A, New York City, B, Philadelphia, C, Cleveland, or D, San Francisco? Correct answer, answer C, Cleveland. As noted in GuinnessWorldRecords.com, the ill-fated Moondog Coronation Ball at the Cleveland Arena, Ohio, USA, on 21 March 1952 is regarded as the world's first rock and roll concert. Described as the Big Bang of rock and roll, the concert was organized by DJ Alan Freed and music store owner Leo Mintz, and was headlined by saxophonist Paul Williams and his Hucklebuckers. The event was credited with bringing black and white kids together to dance in post-war America, but was abandoned after approximately 30 minutes due to overcrowding and rioting after more than 20,000 revelers stormed the 9,950-seat venue. Counterfeiting and a printing error on tickets for a follow-up ball resulted in more than 20,000 people, some estimates put the number in attendance at 40,000, turning up at the Cleveland Arena on 21 March, causing a full-blown riot that resulted in one man being stabbed as police waded into the mob. The Moondog Coronation Ball was billed as the most terrible ball of them all. Tickets were $1.50 in advance or $1.75 at the door. The event was named after the Moondog Show, a popular program hosted by Freed on Cleveland AM radio station WJW. It was on this show that Freed, nicknamed Moondog, is believed to have coined the term rock and roll. Also on the bill were Tiny Grimes and his Rockin' Highlanders, the Dominoes, Loretta Dillard, and Danny Cobb, who all starred on Freed's radio show. It has been reported that only a handful of songs were performed before police and fire authorities pulled the plug on the event due to overcrowding. On his Moondog show the following evening, Freed offered an apology for the chaos at the Cleveland Arena. He said, "If anyone, even in their wildest imagination, had told us that some 20 or 25,000 people would try to get into a dance, I suppose you would have been just like me. You probably would have laughed and said they were crazy." The Cleveland Arena was demolished in 1977. The site is now the Cleveland headquarters of the American Red Cross. And the answer to our second question, a special section of Central Park in New York was renamed on this day in 1984. What is its new name? Is it A, Strawberry Fields, B, Blueberry Hill, C, California Dreamin', D, Xanadu, or D, E, Kokomo? And the correct answer is answer A, Strawberry Fields. As noted in CentralParkNYC.org, Strawberry Fields is a memorial to the British rock musician and peace activist John Lennon, 1940 to 1980. The memorial consists of a 5-acre landscape near the West 72nd Street entrance and includes the Imagine Mosaic, where many come to pay tribute to Lennon. The memorial's name is a reference to the 1967 song Lennon wrote and performed with the Beatles, Strawberry Fields Forever. Plans for a memorial to John Lennon began to take shape soon after his death. It began with the city's decision to name the area of Central Park across from the Dakota Building, where he and his wife Yoko Ono lived, and where he loved to walk, Strawberry Fields. Ono then began to conceive of a memorial in this landscape and invited countries from all over the world to contribute plants as well as stories to create an international garden of peace. Ono's idea was shaped by her own work as a conceptual artist, as well as her knowledge that Lenin would not have wanted a traditional memorial in the form of a statue. Ono worked with the Central Park Conservancy, including landscape architect Bruce Kelly, to come up with a design for the area that incorporated some of those donations while restoring what was a deteriorated section of Central Park. Kelly sought to integrate the design of the memorial into the park's overall landscape, connecting it to the purpose of the park as a place to find peace and respite. While focusing on the landscape, the design also includes a more formal design element, a mosaic installed into the pavement with the word Imagine in the center, donated by the city of Naples, Italy. Surrounded by benches, the area provides a focal point and gathering space for the many visitors that come to pay homage to Lenin. John Lennon is not physically buried in Central Park in the conventional sense, with a headstone and grave. However, his ashes were scattered in the general area that is now known as Strawberry Fields. This act makes it his final resting place, a deeply personal and spiritual connection to the land itself. Strawberry Fields provides a living landscape that changes and grows over time. So let's close out today's program with that song from 1967 that Lennon wrote, Strawberry Fields Forever.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.
I'm going to Strawberry.